What's up, everybody? How's it going? My name's Indy. The gentleman next to me is Jay Powell from Powell Group Consulting. And welcome to Indie Game Business. And today we've got Michael Schwalbe, and we are talking about voiceovers in your game. We're going to talk about the voiceover industry. We're going to talk a little bit about Michael and his company. And, like, should you have voiceovers in your indie game or not? We're going to weigh some of that stuff out, and we're going to go do a deep dive into it. So, great having you on board, Michael.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me and for rolling with a couple tech issues this morning. This is not my normal studio, but I'm still glad to be here.
So we always start at the same place, Michael. Tell us how you originally got into games and then walk us through your career up to this point.
Sure. Well, I mean, as probably most of the listeners did, I have been in games a lot longer than I've been creating games. You know, I have been a gamer since, I don't know if you call it a game, but since like Paint on my Windows 3.1, like five ever ago. And ever since, you know, going into StarCraft, going into RuneScape, going into Halo, there's just been game after game that have been pivotal in my life. And then I got really excited about, especially starting with Halo, you know, these really gorgeous cinematic games that had this really moving voiceover in it. And I don't remember exactly when it started clicking in my brain that I wanted to make voice my career, or at least voice in games my career. But sometime I was trying to hack it in the music business as a singer, actually, in the early 2010s. It was like 2008 through 2012, I think. And the music industry, if anybody knows, that was like the worst time for the music industry ever. You know, the revenue from CDs was gone, and then streaming had not really caught up. So everybody's going out of business. So I'm like, what can I do with my voice in the meantime? I know. I'll try this voice stuff. And I was doing like, at first I was doing corporate commercial little explainer videos and whatnot. And then just really started to get traction. And then a couple of years in, I decided, you know, I've always loved video games. I need to go, I'm going to try to pivot toward that. Just started going to conventions, meeting developers, joining local industry meetup groups, talking to indie developers, hearing what kind of needs they had. And just over time, the vision, you know, started to coalesce into this is what we're going to do. And now I've been a part of probably more than 100 different games, and from the smallest flash games or like casino mobile games all the way up to a couple dozen of some of the biggest AAA games in the world. And it's been a really great adventure.
So how does one, and I'm asking this in particular for one of my team members, if someone wants to get into voiceover acting, how do they go about doing that at this stage of the industry?
Well, my advice, I get asked that kind of thing a lot. 'Cause for some reason, everybody thinks being a voice actor would be the coolest thing ever. I can't quite explain why, but like I could be talking to Joe random corporate executive and they'd be like, you know what? I've always wanted to be. Everybody just thinks it's cool, and it is cool, but there's a lot behind the scenes that is not nearly so cool. So to rain on everybody's parade a little bit, usually my advice, especially right now, is don't, because the industry is really not in a healthy place. With the rise of AI, a lot of the bread and butter, like entry level jobs, are getting cannibalized. And I don't think, you know, I'm sure we'll talk ad nauseum about that soon enough, but I don't think that's going to like end things forever. But I think the next couple of years at least are going to be really tough. But if you are just insistent, what I would say is you need to have really rock solid home audio. So you need to make your own studio. You need to learn basic audio engineering, and then just get really solid at producing broadcast level audio from your house, because that is going to be 95% of what you do. It'll be 100% of what you do up until you're at like national, like Los Angeles agency level voice acting. And then you got to be really creative and proactive about outreach. You know, and thinking about sales tactics, you got three tenets of basic sales. Who is my client? Where is my client? How do I get in front of my client? And so not just waiting for like people to filter to you, not waiting for an audition to get posted, because I mean, out of auditions, just to give you an idea, I've done probably about 400 auditions in the last 5 months, and I've landed 7. So if you're not proactively getting out there and not just relying on auditions, you're not going to be able to make it a career.
Okay. So one, your advice is much like mine many times. How do I get into games? I'm like, don't.
It's brutal.
let me go ahead and make this easy for you. So when you're doing 400 auditions in 5 months, I'm going to assume you're not traveling to those. I mean, where do they get posted, and how do you do
well?
That?
I'm represented by 11 or 12 different talent agencies, so that's a big part of what is my hair doing. So that's a big part of it, you know, is letting your representatives send stuff to you that they think is good for you. I would say if you're indie and you don't have a talent agency, you're going to find them posted on Twitter or community groups like the Voice Acting Club. Actually, that would be my first piece of advice if you're brand new to voice acting. Go to the Voice Acting Club. Just Google it and go to their Discord server, because it's by far the best voiceover club, voiceover like community on the internet. And then you'll find stuff, you know, you'll build your network and connections and hear what people are talking about. But for most like serious games, they're going to come through talent agencies, which means you have to get to a certain level of bookings and cred, you know, before you can get that. Or you just have to go and meet with developers directly.
The fact that you're represented by 11 agencies absolutely flies in the face and defies everything that I know about being an agent, since I was one for many, many years. So I can safely assume these are all non-exclusive representations. Do they all, how are they separated? Is this
sure.
like based on geography or?
Yeah. So I've got my primary talent agency. I never wear headphones. So I'm like, how do I make this not awkward?
It's okay. You look better than I do. It's all fine.
Well, because my voice isn't coming through my headphones, but yours is. So it's like, I don't know. Anyway, of those, one is my primary agency, and that's my Los Angeles agency, AVO Talent. And then they are like, they get, you know, top dog first dibs. If I get sent the same audition from multiple places, which happens pretty often, my contract says I need to submit to them priority. But they also give me like the best commission, and I have the closest relationship with them. So it makes sense. So then the others are all regional talent agencies. So they might have like Austin, Texas market exclusivity, Chicago exclusivity, Baltimore, Maryland exclusivity, San Francisco exclusivity. And so they're filtering kind of their market stuff over to me. You know, my Kansas City agency might send you like local or regional agriculture, like radio commercials. And I'm not going to get those from my talent agent in Los Angeles, you know? So if you, by kind of having this network of different places, you get a better breadth of opportunities sent to you. And I'm auditioning a lot less than I used to. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I would have done almost double that many auditions by this point in the year. Jesus. But I'm trying to audition less because I'm so sick of the audition grind.
That, I mean, it does help explain when it's like, okay, these are not all game companies. You are getting stuff that's like,
I have three McDonald's. Yeah, I have three McDonald's commercials running right now. I've got, oh man, some corporate explainer video for Beloit Insurance or Beloit Healthcare that is like renewing. And so, yeah, I've got an audio book that I'm in the middle of doing. Even if I was only doing video games, I still wouldn't be able to make ends meet even by this point, because character work in games just doesn't pay like it should. I do anime. I'm like one of the leads in an anime called Boruto. His name is Kawaki. Anime pays even worse than video games. So yeah, you really got to just wear so many hats, which is also why I had started casting for games too.
So tell us a little bit about that. What was that transition? And when you say you're casting for games, what does that entail?
Yeah, so it wasn't really even a transition. It kind of happened from the get-go. I was at GDC and I was talking to developers, and I was like just wandering the floor. This was my, you know, who are they, where are they, how do I get in front of them, just go and start handing out cards and stuff. And so I was talking to a developer called Gumi SG, Singapore, and they were in the process of making this new battle or a new gacha game called Wakfu Raiders, based on their Wakfu IP that you might have heard of. And I was showing them my demos and stuff, and they were like, well, we probably going to need a lot of actors. Do you know other actors? And could you cast this? And I was like, yes. Yes, I do casting. Yeah, I can definitely do that for you. And so they were like, okay, great. And then much to my shock, a couple weeks after the convention, they emailed me and said they wanted to move forward. I was like, you are very trusting, because my... Because, you know, I was a full-time actor, but, you know, for a couple of years, and I had a really serious studio, but I hadn't really done anything in games. And so my credits and like resume was basically trust me, bro. But I was like, you know, I'm a professional voice actor and casting director, and then I just never proved myself wrong. And I quoted the project, and they were like, so how much will this cost? And I was like, well, shoot, I'd be happy if I made like anything, but I can't say that. Let's see. What was your anticipated budget? And then they came back with three times more than I'd been planning on asking. And I said, oh yeah, that was somewhere in the neighborhood of what I was thinking, except I was thinking four times more. So I upped it even again. And they're like, okay, yeah, sure. I was like, you know, ran around my house, and this is like 10 years ago. Nothing makes me run around the house anymore. But that was the start. And I ended up doing like, I think I recorded like 25 of the characters myself. And then I got, I did have a pretty big network. So I just assembled a spreadsheet with like all my actors' information and microphones, and then sent auditions out and made an email list and just like started doing it, and got them, I don't know, 100 different actors to choose from over the course of the next month or so. I mean, I assembled a list of about 100 over the casting process and then sent them all over. But normally casting calls for those curious and auditions, you get like 24 hours to respond. It's very fast paced.
Oh my God. And so you get the thing, you have 24 hours, you have to record whatever they sent you as a sample and you get it back to them.
Yeah,
God, that sounds absolutely.
I usually try to give 48 hours because I don't want to be that bitch. But like most of my agency auditions are 24 hour or less turnaround. Sometimes you'll get it and it's like 7 p.m. and you think you're done for the day. And it's like, well, this is due at 9 a.m. tomorrow. So either I wake my ass up first thing and do it, or I just go back, trudge back to the booth.
Oh, my God. So question from the Discord. Adrian asks, how do you find those agencies, and do you have recommendations for East Coast creatives?
Finding agencies. I would say, unless you are already booking a lot on like pay-to-play casting sites like yourvoices.com, your Voice123. There's some other casting sites where you pay like an annual subscription and then you get access to all the jobs that people go post there. Every one of those sites suck for various reasons. So I don't use any of them, but it is possible, you know, Fiverr is kind of like that. it is possible to get your career started over there. The trouble is that those sites have all been around for a while, and then you have a lot of times have difficulty breaking through the like wall of established people that are already over there, like scooping all the jobs up. So you need some kind of booking, whether it's like direct clients that you've reached out to yourself, or the pay-to-play sites, or you know, some other method. You need to have some sort of established career before you really start courting agencies, because they're kind of the next step up. Now, if it's a very small local agency, they'll probably just take you. But most regional agencies are really, there's a lot of people right now that want to do voiceover, especially after the pandemic, because you could do it remotely. It can pay pretty well. So sometimes. And so a lot of people were like, well, I could do this from in my bathrobe from my house. And so the market is just heavily oversaturated right now with aspiring hopefuls. So you got to want it more than them.
So it's basically like the rest of indie development.
Yeah, yes. Pretty much.
You got it. Except there's an even smaller, I don't want to say barrier to entry, but perceived barrier to entry.
Right. That's the thing. And that's a huge point, is that compared to like learning to make a game, which you can kind of see from a distance, all the moving parts, voice acting is absolutely as much of a barrier to entry. And you have to know as many, if not more, different hats to wear, because you need the marketing and business side of things, the massive like organizational capacity to juggle all these different auditions and open jobs, making sure you're getting paid and invoicing people, you know, for each individual little thing. You also need to know audio engineering. You have to be a good actor. You have to do all sorts of, especially on my side, like when I'm casting or directing sessions for different developers, then you have to be able to communicate well, like write good emails, or like know how to write scripts if you have to like write on the fly or change, you know, your Chinese client script to be more to have better prosody for the English listener. Like there's so many different things to really, if you're going to really crush it in this industry. So it just, most of those are not quite as obvious at the first glance. And so you think, well, I can sit here and read a book into a microphone. Yeah, but can you do the rest of it? And I'm not, you know, trying to say that it's rocket science. It's not. You know, if you really grind at it for a year, two, 3 years, you can. I mean, I went from nothing to my first union national commercial in 2.5 years. So you can go pretty quickly. Not that that's normal, but it does take a lot of time invested, and you need to have the passion for getting good first before you have the passion for trying to get credits or bookings or, you know, whatever.
All right. So let's look at it from the other end of the table. You know, a lot of indie devs, I mean, everybody wants their game to have voiceover. It does give it that extra bit of polish, that, you know, bigger air of authenticity to it. Mm-hmm. With the fact that the market is so flooded with people who want to do voice acting, how do indie devs find good people? And how, you know, if they start listening or they start talking to folks, how do they figure out if they're good? What, I mean, what makes a quality voiceover actor stand out versus some person in their bathroom?
Absolutely.
In their bathroom.
Absolutely. Well, I'm obligated to answer that question by saying, you hire me. and I'll tell you, I haven't said my full scope of what I'm actually doing for developers yet. And I'm going to use that to segue into how you can avoid kind of the pitfalls of bad voiceover. So my shtick that I've kind of put together over the years, after talking to dozens, hundreds of developers and finding out what most of them need, is especially for smaller teams, you've usually got one audio guy. You've got, and they're usually doing sound design and composition. And then also the task of getting and sourcing and vetting and, you know, organizing sessions. Like, that's a huge additional ask for that already overworked one audio guy. And so I come along and I say, hey, I'm going to be the one point of contact, your one-stop shop. I will cast out of my now list of more than 500 vetted professional actors with their own studios. I will cast, round up the choices for you. I will let you either pick from a short list that I weed out, or I can just cast it for you directly, again, based on just I know what is going to sound good for these roles. But then I will organize the sessions. I will hire the production assistant. I will deliver the files. I will have the scripts, like, or take your script and polish it for you. I will, like, get all that stuff put together so that then I can just send you, here's a Dropbox like thing with organized files per character, per line, spliced and ready for you to implement in FMOD or WISE or whatever it is, you know, so that then you don't have to worry about it. And then I can even handle the taxes. You know, if you want me to do the 1099s for the talent, the contractors, I'll do that too. Cause I know how much or how many plates y'all are juggling on your side between the deliverables and the implementation and then the deadlines that you're on. So I just, my actual service is just making lives easier, you know? So then if you're a developer and you're not at a point where you think you want to hire me, also, we're not as expensive as you think we are. Remember I said voiceover pays pretty badly.
That's where it works in your favor.
Yeah, it does. It does work in your favor. I mean, for Slave Zero X, or well, here, I'll take System Shock. So I cast and directed the System Shock remake for Night Dive Studios recently, or 2 years ago now, I guess. But I think we did all the voiceover, including my fee, the casting fee, and everything. I think it cost $22,000 for the entire thing, which is, in game development terms, not a lot of money. And we had
something the size of System Shock.
Yeah. No, and we didn't do it union, and I tried to flip it union, but the budget, for anybody that knows the production life cycle of that game, was insane. So we were limping to the finish line, so we had to do it non-union. But I mean, we still got Deborah Wilson and Alex Lee, and like, I mean, I pulled some heavy hitters in for that project. So you can, yeah, literally get most actors for less than $1,000 per person for a game that's like that size. And there's a decent bit of voiceover in that. So anyway, so that gives you an idea. But things that, if you are like, I'm doing voice for my very first one person Stardew Valley thing, and I want some little cutscenes here and there, how do I find out whether or not this person sucks? The things you want to listen for are just, I know this sounds basic, but like audio quality, like ask them for what their signal chain is. If they don't know what that is, that's a big red flag. A signal chain is the path the signal goes from microphone through your gear, through the cable, through your preamp or whatever, to or from your mouth to your computer, essentially. And so you want ideally a XLR studio mic, not a USB mic like a Blue Yeti, because those have more self noise in the recording, and just a treated space. So if you just know the questions to ask, you can usually weed out most people pretty easily that aren't, you're not going to want them in the project. So ask, do you have a treated recording space? Do you have an XLR studio microphone? And to be clear, even if they have a Yeti, as long as the space is treated, it's still probably going to be pretty okay. And then if you're listening to auditions, listen for, what I listen for is first the, like pops, clicks, mouth noises, those can be cleaned up. But if there's big plosives, which is the puff of air against a non-pop filtered microphone, those immediately destroy a performance and destroy the audio. Same with clipping. You know, if there's places where it just cuts out or it peaks, like if there's a big yell, you'll hear it get crunchy or distorted. You can't fix that no matter how much audio processing you do to it. So you want to avoid people that don't have the capacity to moderate the gain, like the levels on their microphone. And then lastly, from a directing standpoint, because some of you are going to have to direct actors too. the most important thing a director can know or can tell an actor is to stop focusing on the voice and focus on the emotion, the feeling. Because so many new actors that I hear, you know, maybe they've got a cool video game voice that say, maybe they got a good orc voice. And so they're down here and it's got some gravel to it or whatnot. And so they're so fixated on maintaining that voice placement that they forget about like the actual acting part of things. And nothing will kill a good game faster than bad voiceover. So my advice is just tell them to focus less on the voice, focus on the performance, immerse themselves in that scene. And hopefully that will at least get them a little bit outside of their head, because probably a lot of them, this might be their first game too. So I'll shut up there, because otherwise I'm just going to keep rambling. There's a lot to say.
Yeah, my sound chain goes from me to this mic to somewhere in that box down there on the other side of the – I have no fucking idea. System Shock is a good segue, though. I mean, Steven and Larry are good friends of mine, and I love, you know, the whole premise of that company, and I love the success of it. I mean, for those of you who don't know Night Dive's origin story, it was basically Steven sitting going, I wish I could play this old game and it doesn't work for shit. So
yeah,
I'm just going to buy the rights and fix it. And that's what happened, God, 10 years ago, maybe. But that's what, you know, happens. And we've had Larry on here multiple times. And Larry is also another good friend of mine and makes my job easy because he comes prepared with everything to these talks. So I can basically get it started and then just go eat lunch. It's fantastic.
Yeah, he definitely just is one to just go once you get everything.
He has one
speed. I'm kind of like that too.
it's fantastic. So, you know, System Shock is going to be a bigger project than a lot of folks listening here, but it's not outside the realm of possibility for a lot of these projects.
No.
Walk us through, you know, that process as much as you feel like, and explain how a project like that is structured and how it works.
Sure. So, that's a good example, because that's probably the biggest of the me doing everything projects that I've done. Cause like, for instance, last year I did, I don't know, 800 hours of recording session direction, for MiHoYo. And I didn't have to do anything except just tell actors how to do better, you know, how to make their performance really click and some script revisions. So, but System Shock, I was doing everything. Slave Zero X is another one of that caliber of like game that I had to do everything for. And that one was Union though. So the process was different. So I might give a little like comparison between doing it non-union, doing it union. Because you should absolutely do it union if you possibly can. It's not that much more expensive, and it's just you should do that. Anyway, so System Shock, I think it's also a good example because System Shock's development was so insane and so many pitfalls that maybe you can avoid some of these problems in your production. So System Shock, I originally hooked up with the audio lead, John Paros, at GDC, my first GDC. This is in 2015, 2016, sometime in the before times. And we were just at a mixer at dinner and started talking with him. And he's like, oh, well, I mean, we're going to need voice stuff for our demo we're about to do. We're about to make a demo for our Kickstarter. So can you cast that? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, within 6 months or so, they reach out. They tell, here's your script. Here's the characters. Like, here's the auditions, or how many auditions that we want to collect. And then I send it out to my list. I get them. I cast the game, or the demo rather. And we get the demo made. And then they do a Kickstarter. They raise $1.4 million and they fund it. So it's very funded by this point. And we're all like, and I'm like, this is going to be awesome. And so everybody's super pumped. They've got Actually, the one actor that I did not cast was they brought the original Shodan back, Terry Brosius, from the original. And Terry and then her husband kind of did their own thing. And I literally never even talked to them or interfaced with them at all. It was kind of surreal and creepy, like, because Shodan is surreal and creepy. But like, we just get audio from like the ether that this other producer was doing. And then it'd be like, all right, it's like you like knock on a door and then just, and then you take it. I don't even know what they charged. Cause it was so weird to have like these two totally isolated, siloed, like acting and voice pieces for that. But anyway, that's not normal. So we cast the demo, got this huge Kickstarter funding. And they've got, you know, System Shock laptops and System Shock this and like that for all the like backers and whatnot. And then somewhere along the, I don't know if Larry was involved at this point or what, but somewhere along the line, they decided, you know what we should do with this money is we should make a lavish, amazing, like slice of we'll do the whole first level and we'll make it just amazing. And then we'll use that to get like major AAA funding for it from publishers or something like that. Anyway, long story short, they blew all the money, the whole $1.4 million, and the game was not made. They made a really great like proof of concept. And then I don't know all the politics behind the scenes, you know, that happened, but, the deal just kind of fizzled. And so then it was like, whoa, what about the game? And so I think pretty much the whole team ended up getting laid off. And so it got shelved. And meanwhile, Night Dive is big enough that they, and Steven ambitious enough that they were still having revenue coming in from these other titles, you know, that they're doing, Turok. And I don't know, they've got quite a few amazing games by this point, but like, over the next like 6 or 7 years, it would be like nothing, nothing, nothing. Oh, hey, we're reassembling the team. And then this time we're going to build it in Unity though. So we're totally starting from scratch. And then oh, JK, the production manager like didn't mesh with something and the whole team got laid off again. It was like, oh my God. So literally, I think they, on the third iteration of the System Shock team, I'm hearing all this filtered through John, the audio lead. You know, he's like, hey, they brought me back again. Oh, I got fired again. Oh, they brought me back again. So it's so ridiculous. And so then finally, like six or seven years after our initial meeting, he's like, it's happening. We got the funding. We're making the game for real. They brought me back. Like, give me an estimate for how much everything is going to be. And so I kind of did a basic breakdown of like, here's the, you know, 20% casting fee. We're going to need 22 actors, probably for non-union. We could do a minimum of $500 per session. It's usually structured at $250 an hour per studio hour. And then a non-union is 2 hour minimum. And then I got, I don't know, 1300 auditions across all these characters. And I'm like, yeah, you need the audition scripts to be formatted this way. And then hired production assistant. We scheduled sessions. We did like 40 hours of recording sessions in like 9 days because of course in everything it's do it now. And so we got it finally put together and sent all the audio over. And then that was that. I sent out the invoices and got them paid. And then the game got further polished and released as a masterpiece, which is, I'm still shocked, no pun intended. Not shocked that they made a masterpiece, shocked that a game that had such a tumultuous development cycle was able to pull it together, which I think is a testament to the strength of Steven and Larry's leadership, that they could navigate rather than just washing their hands of that, like a lot of people would have had to.
But I mean, part of that too, you know, from the business side is you've got a company that's not run by just fiscal executives. You know, this is something that they truly wanted to do. And
that is so key.
Yeah, it is. And so, you know, they want to keep finding a way to get it done. And it's EA not like you're never. Dealing with a publicly traded company, which ironically they're a part of now. But there's where somebody's just, yeah, they got bought by Atari. Really? They got bought by Atari like a year ago. Yeah. And so, I mean, but a lot with these publicly traded companies, they look at, you know, there's probably two or three points during System Shock's development where they would have said, we're done.
Oh, easy. Yeah. I mean, if it was owned by Sony or Microsoft or something, it would have been toast. And, you know, maybe they wouldn't have like shuttered the whole studio. I mean, maybe they would have, but they at the least would have been like, this is, you know, no longer the return on investment is just not there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it would have been toast. So it kind of speaks to the strength of like, this can't be, games cannot be a solely number focused thing. Cause look at what they're doing to our boy. You know, they're killing the industry with these layoffs and the constant meat grinder of talent to produce what? Like, I mean, layoffs and in instability and the brain drain of just constantly gutting teams for short-term gains. And so if you want passion or projects that inspire passion, you've got to invest passion into them. And System Shock is proof of that it can happen and work.
So you touched on AI earlier, and I know it's a very touchy subject in a lot of places in the industry, and sound is definitely one of them. Me personally, when I think AI and voiceover, all I hear is that annoying ass voice in TikTok that immediately makes me turn off all audio, you know, to my phone if possible.
Mm-hmm.
Where is AI fitting in, or where is it being an issue?
Everywhere. It's the death of human creativity if we don't stop it. But hold on. I've got a great photo here. So there's a... I'm no scholar on AI, but I am perhaps more personally affected by it than most, given that my voice has been synthesized, stolen, put on a Twitter account named my home address and used to say racial slurs and hate speech, like to with my
face. That's nice.
Like, yeah. I got interviewed by Vice about it. Fun stuff. No, people, it's a massive problem. And not just because of what it's doing to creative jobs, but also the grotesque invasion of personal privacy, the grotesque like it's violation of our personal integrity. There's not much that is as personal to you as your voice. And so every voice that you use for your stupid meme that like makes Joe Biden do Call of Duty shit is like those things are coming from people like me and the other data set that they've scraped off of the internet and used to generate these. It's not a funny meme. It is extremely harmful. It should not be used under any circumstance. And it probably won't be for much longer. 2 days ago, there was another huge blow against generative AI as they ruled that companies probably can't just go figure, take an entire like artist's portfolio for free without compensation or consent and then profit off of it.
What a concept.
You know, like what the law already says. So like maybe just enforce the fucking law. Anyway, as you can tell, I'm not like passionate about this or anything, but here's the thing. The funniest thing is that probably the silver bullet revolver against AI is a single photo that was taken in 2011. And I'm going to show you the photo. Maybe you've seen it. This is maybe the most important photo in the history of humanity.
Yes.
This is the photo. And this photo of a macaque was taken by the macaque. And the copyright battle that ensued over who owns the copyright to that photo lasted for like 6 years till 2017. And ultimately, the courts ruled that only human-made creations are eligible for copyright protection. And that single photo and that battle, that single result has now resulted in a cascade of legal victories against generative AI and against people that are like the prompt generators that are trying to copyright these regurgitations of human-made media through the lens of Midjourney. And because they cannot be copyrighted, it means that probably there's not going to be a like permanent staple. The AI generative stuff is not going to be a permanent staple of the creative industries, because no big budget game, book, movie is going to use a poster or assets that can't be copyrighted, because they could just take it and do, you know, put it on a porno and or something or whatever, it is, a horror movie with no protections, no repercussions. You cannot own AI generated assets. So for that reason, if you're an independent game developer that is thinking about using AI in your game, fucking don't, because you can't copyright it. Even beyond the moral and ethical things, if you're somebody that just doesn't care about morals or ethics, think about the pragmatic side of things, about how devastating it would be if you got the next Stardew Valley, Undertale, Vampire Survivors, whatever it is, and oops, you don't own any of the assets. You don't own the soundtrack. You don't own the artwork. You don't own the voices in the game that might be generating your performances. You don't own any of it, so you can't profit or exploit the marketing of any of it. So you're massively hamstringing yourself for really no reason, because none of those things that you would use AI for are that big of a barrier. It's so easy, fam, to find motivated, passionate artists, voice actors, like pixel art people, like whatever it is that you're struggling to get for your game. It's not that hard to find people that will fill those roles for you for low or no pay. Give them a little equity share of the whatever revenue split for your finished title, and just release stuff. Just make stuff, guys. You don't need the AI to do it. And people didn't need the AI to do it for decades now. So don't start now just because you think, oh, there's this new easy path that I can make something. Because nothing hurts the perception of your game as much as seeing AI generated stuff. Like, the market hates it. People, it immediately cheapens your game. It shows people that are playing it that you weren't willing to invest any money or like sweat human creation equity into your own game. So just say no.
I followed that court case, and honestly, I mean,
fascinating, right?
Legal ramifications and business stuff aside, here was my favorite part. There was a lawyer whose job it was to argue that that monkey had rights and copyrights to that photo.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, just stepping back and taking a look at it, that to me was absolutely entertaining. The guy had hilarious. To feel like he was in a Wile E. Coyote Acme, you know, cartoon. It's like, okay, so I have to now argue on behalf of this macaque that he owns the right, or she owns the rights to this video. But it was, that was an absolute thing. And when you listen to it at first, you're like, oh, well, it's not that big a deal. But then the point you make is the very important part. No company is going to go out there and put assets out there that they can't trademark or copyright, because mm-hmm. that is absolute business suicide.
Yeah.
So yes. And part of me is very sorry for that macaque, that, you know, he does not own the rights to anything that he did, but, you know, you got to draw the line somewhere. And
well, you know, he's not the most savvy business person. I doubt he would have monetized.
He takes a good selfie though.
He does.
That was a very good selfie he took. I mean,
look at these teeth. Like,
I mean, seriously, it's an absolute fantastic selfie, but unfortunately, unlike Always Sunny, bird law doesn't apply here, and nor does monkey law. So
yeah, exactly.
okay, let's get back to, you know, what we're doing here. All right, so questions coming in from YouTube from Western World Studio. What is most helpful for a voice actor when contacted by a game dev?
Sure.
And what drives the devs crazy because it's not helpful? Or the voice actors. Yes, voice actor. What drives the voice actors crazy?
So what is most helpful is just structuring the script, like your audition script, well. And so that means having your lines organized so you've got like clear scope of what the lines you want to hear is, with a hopefully decent breadth of like emotional delivery, so that you can show like the highs and the lows of the character that you're trying to audition. If you've got artwork, that is by far the most single most helpful thing that you can provide for an actor, is showing them what they look like, because everything influences the performance. Like how big is their nose? Will there be nasality in it? How tall or skinny are they? If they're a big guy, you know, you have a bigger more resonant voice in perception, you know, not always in practice, but if they've got big orc teeth, that might color how they, you know, talk. So artwork is super, super helpful. Make sure that some editor has gone through it at least a little bit, because like sometimes, especially if it's a client from China or Japan or you know, Russia or something, you'll get scripts that are just plainly not grammatical. And that is problematic for an actor, because then they have to either, you know, pivot on the fly and try to write what they think is going to be the right line or what you meant, or just deliver something that is going to not be what your game wants or needs. And then what drives actors crazy. Oh, and then, as another quick thing, the other stuff you want to provide, any backstory that can lend insight into the character's motivations, hopes, dreams, like their personality. If you've got a voice in your brain, voice references, like say, I envision somebody like Deborah Wilson, you know, doing this role, somebody like Michael Schwalbe doing this role. And then if you've got a YouTube link to like an interview with that person, again, that all these things would make me love you. You know, you don't have to do all of them, but the more that you do, the more info you can provide, the better. Things that drive me crazy, when they just say like, say something that you think will fit. It's your job, fam. This is your role. I'm not creating this character for you. I'm breathing life into your story. So it's a meme, honestly, within the voice acting community, that like if you've got an indie title, there you've got the character, but then the lines are just, I don't know, improv something. No, that's another job. I'm not being paid enough to improv your own characters for you. Now, that being said, it is fun and fine to say, here are 3, 4, 5 lines, and feel free to improv or ad-lib the lines as you see fit, or improv and ad-libbing is encouraged. I love that. I love doing, having the freedom to do extra little mannerisms or little sayings that I think would be appropriate for that character. And you might be surprised as the developer, some of the really interesting choices that you get as a result, but you got to give them something to go off of, you know? And then other things that drive me crazy, this is maybe the one that drives me the most crazy, is when a developer client, and this happens at every level, this is not just an indie thing, has no idea the amount of work that an audition takes and no concept of what an actor's daily life is like. So like a month or so ago, I got an audition, and it was a huge project. So glad I was auditioning for it. Glad it wound up in my inbox. It was some like major, it was like the main villain in some major Netflix like animation. So like a big deal. But they gave me like 5 pages of screenplay sides, and almost all of it was this villain monologuing. And the finished audition was 4.5 minutes of finished audio. It took me more than 2.5 hours to record, edit, like get the different performance options down that they wanted to hear, and then finally put it together for free. You know, like we don't get paid for those. I'm essentially a lottery ticket scratcher for a living, professional lottery ticket scratcher. And so making me scratch one of these tickets for 2.5, 3 hours is not a good return on investment for me, because again, at best I'm booking 1 in 50 auditions that I'm doing. So like you can imagine, that is completely unsustainable and exhausting from our perspective, because usually these roles require a lot of vocal exertion, stress, and strain. So just have a realistic idea of like, how much are you actually going to listen to? Because on average, an audition, you get discarded within the or moved to a shortlist within the first 7 seconds. So you don't need to hear 4 minutes to make a choice. Have a realistic like 3 to 5, maybe 7 lines of dialogue that are going to give you the idea of what you want to hear, and then let the poor actor rest. So yeah, and I think that's probably a good list of the best do's and don'ts.
All right, so you mentioned that no one has an idea of what you do in a day. Walk us through a day. So what is sure. your normal, when you're solely focused on your voice acting world and not your other worlds or anything like that, walk us through what it's like. What are you doing in a day? Because the fact that it takes you 2.5 hours to do 4 minutes of audio, I mean, that's something. That's substantial.
Well, right. And I've done, you know, some 12,000 auditions over the last 10 years of my career. So like, I'm not inefficient. You know, when I say it took me 2 hours, it would probably have taken somebody else like 4. But you've got, it takes a long time for like something of that caliber. Well, this, I don't want to get into why that one took me so long, because that wasn't what you asked. You asked what my day is like. So normally an audition will take, if it's a, especially corporate commercial stuff, you know, it doesn't take me much time to sit down, pull up my script and go get $500 lease bonus cash on Highlander if you act now, you know, or new at McDonald's, the new $1 McChicken, which doesn't exist anymore because everything's $3.50. McDonald's, ba-da-ba-ba-ba. You know, like I could do that in 5 minutes. Or 10 minutes or something at most, but like it's a lot different when it's a whole like monologued multiple scene thing. And so my usual process is, well, usually I know what I'm going to have to do the night before. And so I kind of like plan things out the evening prior to see like, okay, this one is due at 11. So I need to do that one first. And then we got these two for this game is going to be due at 1. So then we'll do that. This one's going to be really vocally strenuous. I'll leave that one for last. And so you do kind of organize like what your day of auditions is going to be like, and then sit down, make sure there's no like rush bookings or something that you just immediately need to crank out. Like I do the voice of 93.5 Today Radio, Toronto's radio station, CFXJ. I do the radio imaging bumpers, and those are like same day turn and burn. You know, if you've got a new promotion for new Taylor Swift tickets in the Eras Tour, like you got to get those out quick so they can put that on the radio like same day. So seeing what, you know, the deliverables are that are going to be really urgent, getting those out, doing the auditions that are going to be due at various points during the day, begging your agent for a little more time and apologizing when you're late on one of them. And then, you know, after that, seeing, okay, what time is it? How much more time do I have in the day? Let's crank out 2 hours of this audiobook that I'm working on, which isn't due for, you know, a month, but like you got to take bite-sized chunks out of it as the month goes to get that put away. And then, you know, personal things, if you've got any time left, I'm way less busy the last couple months than I was like last year, for instance, when I was directing full time. I was doing like as many as 40, 45 hours of sessions for that. So back then, you know, the day was like wake up at 6:30, log into your first session of the day that somebody else scheduled for you, tell them how to sound like an artist for the next 8 hours or, you know, break for lunch somewhere in there, get done with my last session of the day for that, do a 4-hour Boruto session for, or video game session for Fallout 76 or something else. And then find time to do 2 or 3 hours of auditions for the tomorrow's projects. After that, do emails for an hour, go to bed at 1:30, wake up at 6:30, repeat for like a year. So yeah, things can get pretty savage when you're really on that grind.
So the next question comes in from YouTube as well. The standard payment for voiceover seems to be calculated on a per line basis, but in your experience, you're shaking your head already. No. How open is the VA community in payment on a per word basis?
This
does payment happen?
Yeah, this is wrong from a very basic standpoint. Now, they're not wrong that standard payment for independent acting. I'm trying not to be like elitist or like sound like a jerk. There are like three or four tiers of acting. I'm already like digging myself into a hole. So there's your like AAA national stuff and union games, and those are paid per session. And a session under the interactive media agreement through the union is $956.50 for 4 hours minimum, with up to three voices. And then there's an additional, after the strike in 2016, an additional secondary session compensation that scales upwards for the number of sessions that you do. So first one, you'll have the $956 plus $75. Second one, $956 plus $125. $956 plus $175. And then it's $175 for a couple. It ends up culminating in something like $956 plus $325 for your 10th session for a game, which I've never, ever had a game that needed 10 sessions. Actually, that's not true. Not a union game that needed 10 sessions. But then it resets, and then you're done with the secondary compensation. It was an effort to get sessions back in line with what they should have been, because there hadn't been a video game strike in like 15 years or something prior to that. So anyway, so that's how it's structured on the like biggest level is, and that's scale, you know, then you could get double. I've been paid double scale before. That's really, feels really good. And so then there's below that, there's your non-union kind of professional standard, which is, like I said, calculated on studio hours, usually $250 an hour is the minimum. I try to get between $300 to $400 because there's no residuals, you know, there's no royalties. For instance, when I did all the voice work for Slay the Spire, a game you may have heard of, little mobile game, and
a small game. Yeah.
And
very niche.
Right. I guess it is. I guess that, yeah, that probably sounded like a dick thing to do, to say, but I did that in 20. That was another GDC contact. And I did that 7 years ago, 8 years ago. And I charged them $400 for all the voice sprites and everything for the game, and knocked them out, sent them off. And I'm not saying they should have paid me more, but I'm saying that like you are in like within your rights to ask for more because you don't know what is going to hit. And they didn't need to pay me anything extra for any of the little nonverbals or emotes or battle sounds I did for them. And they didn't, but like that $400 doesn't feel so good when you're like, oh, that game sold tens of millions of copies. So then below the non-union 250 to 350 scale, you can find like paid independent. There's like an indie developer, indie voice actor community that I would say is kind of the Twitter sphere, like the Twitter actors, charge this. You'll find this a lot in like the voice acting club. You'll see this too. And then they will charge on a per line basis, anywhere from like $1 to $4 a line. And I don't like per line basis because lines are wildly inconsistent. You know, I've had games where a line in the script is 5-6 sentences. Obviously, that's going to be very different than a line, which is get down, you know, grenade out. Like, so I think, and to then your question, well, then shouldn't you pay per word? Like, that would be better. But even that is not a great metric because per word stuff is usually like business or medical narration. Stuff that is just very consistent. You know, when I'm doing my audiobooks, I know that I'm going to usually get somewhere in the neighborhood of 9,300 words per hour, per finished hour of dialogue, if it's not like super dense copy. But games don't operate that way, you know? So much the same way that a villain's like triumphant monologue at the pinnacle of their scene is not going to be the same as like a really quiet scene where the main character is just contemplating life. And yeah, man, I don't know. But also when it just gets nickel and dimey, you know, it just gets not fun. And who wants to sit there and like, okay, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It just sucks. Just kind of like, it's better to do just a project payment, have a budget. What do I think this is worth? I've got 200 words of copy. Would you do it for $100, random internet actor? And then they can just say, yeah, sure, or no. You know, so the more granular you get, the more irritating it is for everybody. And it ends up making the actor feel like you're more interested in pinching pennies than you are like collaborating on a finished product together.
All right, one more question, and then we'll let you get back to your busy, busy day. From House of Jen, what things do you consider when deciding if you want to take a non-union gig? And real quick, you don't have to go into much depth. Explain union versus non-union.
Sure. So union is very, very important for we actors. I am a union actor, but I'm what is called FICOR. It's called stands for financial core, and it's a legal qualification, I guess, where back 100 something years ago, the government told all the unions, in not just the actors union, all the unions, that said, and they said, you are not allowed to coerce somebody into not being able to support themselves. So basically, if an actor says, I solemnly swear that I cannot make ends meet only doing union work, and I declare financial core status, that allows you to take both union and non-union gigs. And then you become what is called a dues-paying non-member. You lose your voting rights. You lose your official membership card. But you still get most of the benefits of being a union member. For instance, I still get union healthcare because I meet the qualifications. You have to do a certain amount of union work every year to get past that benchmark, but it's really, really good healthcare because it's you know, SAG-AFTRA, it's the actors, like celebrity healthcare basically. But you have to make, I want to say it's $26,000 in union bookings a year in order to pass the threshold to qualify. So at any point we can lose our healthcare if we have a bad enough year. So then on top of, you know, not making much money that year, you also don't have healthcare. So because of that, having and pension, you can also get pension credits for future pension payouts. So it is so, so valuable and important for us to get union work so that we can have those benefits. And something like 90% of actors don't qualify for that healthcare. It's or 87%. It's a huge number. So every new gig that can go union, we try to flip it and convert it through a paymaster. So there are studios like Soundbox LA, really most major production houses, that if you're at a slightly higher level, you can reach out to them. And they will walk you through the paperwork and to become union signatory for this project. And then not only does that allow you to get access to the primo union actors, and not just FICOR people, but like the really big shots, for, again, not as much as you would think, it also gives us a chance to qualify or to get more qualification for healthcare and pension and stuff. So really, really useful. The number one way for a non-union actor to become eligible to join the union is by booking a union game. And a union game can hire any actor it wants. Any union project can hire any talent that it wants to with what's called a Taft-Hartley form. And Taft-Hartley basically turns an actor union for that project, for this one project. And in so doing, then now they become eligible to join the union because they have gotten this form. So lots and lots of benefits to doing your game union. Better talent. There's protections involved for both you and the actors. You know, the scope of the game and what you're allowed to ask for is better defined. So there's a lot of reasons to go union, and most of the reasons not to are are kind of propaganda, if I'm honest. So I don't know if that actually answered your question.
All right. No, you did a good job of explaining the union versus non-union. The question was, what do you consider when deciding if you want to take a non-union?
Now that you know why you would want to take union, the reason you would not want to take non-union is to pay your mortgage, you know, to get more money, because there are not a ton of union gigs. And it's really, really hard to make ends meet with only union work. I still definitely couldn't. It's just getting tough out there, especially as the smaller bread and butter jobs dry up. So the reason I would take non-union, firstly, I'd try to get union scale commensurate, you know, if I want to make sure that the game is still paying a good amount. But some of the times that I want to take a non-union game, it's stuff like mentoring or working with a local game dev game jam or, student projects. I love working with students, like new animators that are coming out of college or new game jam. Yeah, I just said that. But I enjoy contributing to things like that. And you can't do that through the union. So there are a lot of reasons. Or if you want to join, like maybe there's a passion project for a friend of yours that you like, one of my good friends is pivoting from voice acting into game dev. And he made an awesome, hilarious game called Don't Pee. That it's got like 94% positive ratings on Steam. It's proof of concept to show that his little studio can make a game and get it out and release it and make some money on it. It's like $2. It's hilarious. But they didn't have like any budget for that. So if he had wanted to do voiceover for that, you would have to do it non-union to do like a revenue split or something like that. There's no revenue split agreement in the union contract. So that would be some of the considerations for going non-union.
Michael, thank you so much. This has been absolutely fantastic. So this is your spot. This is your plug. Tell people how to find you, how to book you, how to hire you.
Yeah, you can reach me directly via email, and I don't have a life, so feel free to email me. Even if you just have questions, even if you're not hiring me, I mostly just want to make people's lives easier and provide some light into a pretty inscrutable and weird industry. So my email is michael@michaelschwal.be. So it's schwal.be. My website is michaelschwal.be. Jay, if you'll put that in the chat, or I don't know where this is going, but
we'll put it in the stuff at the bottom thing.
You can also find me on
Dan does that.
Okay. You can also find me on Twitter at what he said VO. That's where I'm most active. At what he said VO on Twitter. On Instagram, it's at actor Michael Schwalbe, because I don't have any similar branding across any of my stuff, because there's like one other doctor who's hoarding some of my SEO. Darn you, other Michael Schwalbe. And as for stuff that I'm trying to promote right now, if you are listening to this and you are an aspiring actor, or you are an actor that is trying to do more independent stuff, I have a webinar that I am teaching in, 8 days. It's the 25th rendition edition of my Extreme Vocals for Extreme Roles class. I'm also a professional metal singer of 16 years. I've done metal for metal vocals on game soundtracks for Slave Zero X, also for PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds Mobile, for McDonald's commercials. Like, I do metal, and I'll teach you how to do those techniques safely and sustainably in your acting. So Extreme Vocals for Extreme Roles. You can find that on my Twitter. Oh, and lastly, I just put out my first new song with my band in like 5 years. So if you're on Spotify, go look up Invicta Sacrifice the Week. It's not a love song. It's a loathe song. So awesome. That came out today.
See, look at that new drops. This exclusively on Indie Game Business.
Yeah. Just for you.
Dan. Where's Dan?
There. There I am. Ooh, I can do that. I was in a metal band. The pigs up. Excellent. I love metal. I grew up with metal. Michael, this has been awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks, and wait. I got to unmute here in Discord before Ash says something about it. Oh, dang it. Charity said something about it. There, I'm unmuted in Discord, Ash. There. That's a special thing people get if they watch. They don't get to see me muted.
And I am in the Discord, so feel free to tag me, ask me questions if anybody wants to keep the discussion going. I might be a little distracted. I had a family emergency, so I'm at my grandma's house right now. But I'll be around for the next few days.
That's good. We hope everything's okay at your grandma's as well.
Everything will be fine. But my grandpa's probably about to pass, but he's had a great long life, and it's long time in coming. So we're all here to celebrate him and celebrate the joy of life together.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you so much, Michael, for coming on here. If you're not on our Discord, discord.gg/indiegamebusiness, you can also go to indiegamebusiness.com and you can sign up for our newsletter right there. We have an awesome publisher list and an investor list. Also, I want you to check out some Indie Game Business merch on there as well. Our next conference is in September, so that's a ways away, but we have guests lined up for weeks. So if you're in our Discord and you see all the events lined up, and there's even more that's lined up that I haven't scheduled yet, but we're super excited week after week after week after week. Thank you so much. Everyone have an awesome weekend. Thanks, Michael.
Take care, everybody. Thanks.